had touched the sky. Then they took him and broke him on a wheel. But before he died, he laughed. He said, "Oh, green shelter of long grass, oh, woman face of earth moving side to side, be naked for my children as for me, a cobra, a cobra." And put that in the museums, and we have robbed ourselves of a great heritage. Merido is doing something to bring us some of this Indian poetry. I may have to ask her to read her poem, unless I can immediately put my fingers on my Indian poems that I have here. Here we are. To read or learn about the history of poetry, it's usually traced back to the classic origins and the primitive rites of Greece, the rites of Dionysus and so forth, and there's a great deal of truth to this. But we can trace poetry back in this country to the Indians. The Indians have a relation to nature which is expressed in their poems. Each Indian has his own poem in many tribes, and it's a great crime to take his poem. You can't do it. It's only after he dies that it becomes a property of the tribe. Mary Austin speaks about going on a voyage in California many years ago with an Indian guide, and at sundown he would step over the road and bow down and murmur something. She asked him what he was doing. He said, "I'm reciting my poem." When I left, with his own poem he was reciting. When I left home, my wife and I agreed that at sundown every day I would turn toward her and she would turn toward me, and we would each recite our poem, and that would bring us in communion. It makes us together. So it's typical of the role that poetry and song play among Indians. It's part of the relationship to life and to nature. Brings them in contact with the friend of the soul of man, as I believe that we might translate their reverence for the nature. Well, I will try to give you a sample of on themes that are familiar themes in all poetry. For example, here's one of a love song. The man sings this. It's a long duet. I'm just going to read you a few lines from the man's part. He says, "My parents think they can separate me from the girl I love. We have vowed to love each other while we live. Their commands are vain. We shall see each other while the world lasts. Yes, let them say or do what they like. We shall see each other while the rocks stand." Here's a lament of a man for his son. This is a very familiar theme, because in the Bible, that famous passage when David learned that his son Absalom has been killed. He says, my son Absalom, would God I had died to thee. Well, here's a lament of an Indian man for his son. I don't think he knew the Bible had this theme in it, but maybe a similarity. "Son, my son, I will go up to the mountain, and there I will light a fire to the feet of my son's spirit. And there will I lament him, saying, oh, my son, what is my life to me? Now you are departed. Son, my son, in the deep earth we softly laid thee in a chief's robe, in a warrior's gear. Surely there in the spirit land thy deeds attend thee. Surely the corn comes to thee here again. But I here, I am the stalk that the seed gatherers, seeing empty, afar, left standing. Son, my son, what is my life to me? Now you are departed." Well, one more speaks for itself. It's a Navajo song. "My road home is on the trail of peace. In beauty I walk. With beauty before me I walk. With beauty above and about me I walk. On the trail of the evening light with pollen in my voice. Talking God sits with me. Beautifully my country is restored to me. Beautifully my fields, my house, my wife, my children are restored to me. In beauty I walk through all the long returning seasons with dew about my feet. With beauty about my feet, with pollen in my voice." And surely these poems can compare with any air passages from an original poem by Merrill, in which she utilizes and there was a great revival of interest in Indian poetry. But I don't find it today. I had to look for these poems. This is Marital's. Hey, hey, brother, hey! You have given us the little animals, hiding from the fox, the hunter and the hunted, the cry of the wound, hey, oh, hey! In your music, in your wind harp and gut string, is the cry of my grandmother, ooh, yay, oh, yay! In the great river heart of America, man heart, river living, in your eyes, the glint of sorrow, the heart gripped in the wilderness, loosened, gripped and loosened in flowers. Aye, aye, my singers, my deep brothers, to hear you in the house of the slavers, where a man makes plantation poetry, you turn slave irons into harps, slavery science into singing strings. This was written, I believe, to the singers you just heard, the Negro singers. Dumb I listen, given voice, hey ahoy, across bloody rivers, aye, 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 the agony are gone. A come the agony, a gone, a gone, a gone, a gone, and come again, a gone. His hand weaves the wind from the tiny harp, his hand plucks the wind and weaves, circling and plucking the wind, catch the strands of wit, an untired joke, proud and awake. Aye, brother, hoy, you have given us, you take like roses our love, to end like you with a lullaby, a soft whisper, a sharp touch, a hand over your shoulder, a swift hand. Aye, my brothers, ahoy, ahoy, singers. In your music, the anger of my grandfathers, from the heart of our country, from the heart of men, the glut of anger, the eyes of sorrow, the beat of the hunters looking back, the heart gripped in the wilderness, loosened from our black and red and white grandfathers, loosened and cried out from the sweat, tears from the leaves of the body and of the earth. Then the heart, soft beating like a tiny animal, pressing against the dark with fanged teeth. Aye, my singers, ahoy, ahoy, singers, our deep brothers.
Congratulations.
In the tradition, so people wonder, what can we do with these traditions? This is an example. I'd like to give you another example of what I did with this. I made a poem using an Indian, what should we say, push, drive, memory. Quite a difference, I don't think there's any competition. This is a two-voiced poem. You're supposed to hear two voices with a flute in the background. So I'll be the flute, without flute, and the two voices. It's written at Bushkill Falls, which is a waterfall that you have all over the country. Neither spirit nor hawk, that was my voice you heard last night by these willows, calling Wakoba, Wakoba. Yes, this is the secret spring the Indians used to visit. The woods cover up the sky here. It's a sound place to make magic. The waterfall was there when you were asleep. Indians used to trap around the bend. Yes, that's the wigwam your ancestor blew to hell for $1.50. Neither wind nor wolf rustled these willows last night. That was my blood you heard calling Wakoba, Wakoba. I free myself by association. I will be Indian, a native of Dry Tortugas. Give me your blood, give me your copper skin, my fathers. Get me out of this fix, help. I am drowning, mother, drowning in the blood I have spilled over these waterfalls. That was no ghost that moved last night. That was my heart you heard under the willows calling, Wakoba, Wakoba. The day that we were convicted, the day that we were sentenced for 2 years to jail, I finished the translation of this sonnet by Dante. So it has I like it. You know, it took my mind off the procedures. While they were going on with their business, I was going on with my business. Now, a sonnet is a very difficult thing to write, you see. 14 lines, not 13, not 15. It has a very special line scheme. And it's supposed to be very hard to write a sonnet in any language. And when you take a sonnet from one language and put it to another and obey the same rule, that's supposed to be impossible. So I set myself this impossible task to translate Dante in court. And here's what I did with it. By the way, the judge doesn't know I did this. He gave me 2 years. Had he known this, he might have added a year for the court. He might have accused me of trying to overthrow the government by force of summons. This is a sonnet that Dante wrote to Beatrice. Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, his great facility, later in life. Beatrice is also the heroine of that poem. But previously he had met this young girl on the streets of Florence, and about the year 1300, he wrote a book of sonnets and madrigals telling how beautiful she was and how much he loved her. This is one of those sonnets. This is how heavenly she is and pure. She greets someone on the street, they're mute. Their eyes tremble at her passing salute before they dare again to look at her. She goes her way clothed to all who view her in modesty so shining, none dispute her praise. She seems a miracle whose beauty lends earth itself her unearthly allure. She is so beautiful to everyone, not in their eyes only, in the heart's core, that only those who've known it can believe. And from her lips there issues something unspoken, filled with such love, a spirit seems to soar from her, soothing the soul. Live, breathe. You may wonder, what are we going to do with all these? Louis Mumford says that we live today lives on many varied interpenetrating levels. We no longer have the relation with nature that the Indians had and still have in many cases. We live much more complicated lives. I'm glad to see nobody smoking here. Oh yes, somebody smoking. Well, you don't get that tobacco anymore by going out into the fields and taking and planting the leaf drying it and grinding it and making your tobacco, and oh, do you smoke as the Indians do in a ritual way? We smoke for different reasons. By the way, I stopped smoking. Yes. You wonder how I stopped smoking? Yes, good, I'll tell you. I had a heart attack, and the doctor said you have to stop smoking. So then he said, oh, I'm not supposed to. And I thought to myself, what is this cigarette thing that's got me?
Love, oh, cherished love. Love, oh, careless love. Love, oh, careless love. Just see what love has done to me. To live, my darling, is to love. Let played-out old crabs chatter nonsense no one believes. The sun sinks and climbs again. But when our little day is gone, our night is one long, lasting sleep. Let's kiss again then while we can. 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 more. Again, again, my darling Lillian, from our unending store.
Sorrow, sorrow to my heart. Sorrow, sorrow to my heart. Sorrow, sorrow to my heart. When me and my true love have to part.
Now, another Latin poet that's part of the great Western tradition is Horace. When we steal from poets, we like to steal from the best, from Dante and people like Horace. Horace said, you know, that you can be a good engineer or a good lawyer and give satisfaction, but when you're a poet, you have to be the very best. Otherwise, you sink to the bottom. Now, here's Horace, as interpreted by me. I translated the Catullus and also this. And you'll hear accompaniment to Horace, you'll hear Pete Seeger. playing a, something that you may recognize.
By the way, this song is going to be written by Pete Seeger's wife. She's never poetry in her life before. She's sitting up there in his little cabin in the woods, trying to work out some details of the book. And in order to practice, he played music while his wife read the poem. This is the tape you hear. It's not a studio performance.
Love is another key word that is changing its shape. The objects of love face themselves differently.
That's in the book too, but we don't have time to give you everything, so we'll move on.
Oh, brother.
Yes, it's very, very dangerous if I give you the long talk for the poem. Now, this is the horror.
Oh, brothers, behold my scars, my sins, my shame. Horace said it 2,000 years ago. I have cause to fear the regions of the dawn and the red blood of eastern shores. What have I done to keep our young men at home? What steel blows from what new forges to teach us not to blunt our swords against the Arabs and the Asians? And you, elders of Albany, what Arabian treasures do you eye? What chains are you preparing for the Parthians? Among the native girls of the islands, which one will serve your bed after you have machine-gunned her sweetheart? Who dares deny that rivers run uphill and the Hudson flows back to its source when young men of Weehawken give up schoolbooks for an Iberian cuirass? Throw away the wisdom of Jefferson to become conquerors of the world. O pioneers who held promises of better things.
If you noticed before, you may have heard in the song that was on the record, a song called John Henry. It's a very famous and well-known Negro work song. We have taken this song and used the melody and put new words to it and dedicated it to a great American poet, William Carl Williams. He is actually a symbol in this poem for a man who's dedicated his life to poetry and despite the problems that arise. Williams lives in Paterson, New Jersey, Rutherford, New Jersey, and has written a poem called Paterson. And this is our song.
From jail.
Oh, there we go.
Watkins.
I gave you the wrong talk. Just a minute. Maybe we'll give you from jail.
From jail.
While we have it. Yes, I was beside you.
Bill Williams told his captain, well, man ain't nothing but a man. And before I'd let your steam drill beat me down, I'd write a poem with my hand. I'll die with a poem in my hand.
Up Hackensack Meadows, through Hohoka Swamps, past Lake Peconica, and the seven sewers where the poems live in the Paterson of his dreams.
Bill Williams said to his maker, maker, why don't you sing? I'm throwing 12 pounds from my hips on down. Just listen to that cool steel ring. Just listen to that cool steel ring.
Bill Williams said to his maker, a poem's a machine made of words. So smooth, nobody suspects it trims the whiskers off your bleary-eyed universe and gets down to the clean shave under last week's stubble.
Bill Williams told his captain, well, a man ain't nothing but a man. But before I'd let your steam drill beat me down, I'd write out a poem with my hand. I'll die with a poem in my hand.
Well, we arrested him and kept him in jail for 8 years and buried him in the year 1600. And I'd like to read you a poem that I wrote about Giordano Bruno.
The quotations in this are from Bruno's own work. We open with a non-sonnet, and then we put a sonnet to work at the end to sum up the whole poem. In the year of Jubilee, in the early morning, to the chanting of litanies and the songs of the first birds, Bruno, stripped by the servants of justice, bound to a stake for a word. And what was the word? Only one bereft of reason could believe those infinite spaces of the stars, tended by vast and magnificent bodies, are designed only to give us light. How many years were 8 years of a Roman dungeon, racks of the righteous, centuries of doubts, to burn for a word? The earth is but a planet. The ruler of our earth is not man, but the sun. Eyes crackling, arms blackening, the drums and cheers only, hold fast, Bruno. From what an audible voice? You who sentence me are in greater fear than I who am condemned. Burnt alive for a word. Who is more deeply moved by the thought of some other thing does not feel the pangs of death. So in our hearts he burns a 300-year near, not distant torch. In the early morning, the brothers of pity walked into the field of flowers. In the early morning, they burned him. We mapped the universes he saw breathe, alive and peopled by enormous spores, great fruits of galaxies, each one a seed to galaxies that sprout on further shores. This giant order of huge starry beings, hurtling their kisses into freezing voids, are not in love with our small human things, but he loved them and thought they human laws. They keep on breathing there amidst high heat, atoms of flame to atoms, sun to sun, and some are victors, and some know defeat. But in the star buds where the stars come from, does any star burn brighter in the flame than Bruno, burning for the human name? I think with that, it's called a seascope. Below sea ripples, crustacea. You know what crustacea are? They're little tiny crab-like things, you know.
We don't have any sea.
We have no sea. No sea. Not now, but used to have. Mm-hmm. Below sea ripples, crustacea go hell-bent on inhuman business. Is it true they're heading for the Globigerinous ooze on the sea bottom? They hunt among foraminiferous without bothering feelers about such finalities. Who knows better than a crab how delicious the ocean is? In Norman, Oklahoma, unexpectedly, had several college people there, a very renowned professor of psychology, and they were very responsive. Moved down to Phoenix, Arizona, a similar experience. Then we got to Los Angeles, and Reverend Fishman gave me the privilege of sharing the pulpit with him on Sunday morning. Congregation of about 1,000 people, and I read a poem about peace.
I wish you'd play that later.
You want me to play that later?
Yeah. That's a discussion.
Anybody who stays will hear that poem about peace. And we had several other affairs. In San Francisco, there's a tremendous upsurge in poetry in San Francisco. Evenings like this in San Francisco are taking place all the time, two or three at a night sometimes. One of the young women there told me that in San Francisco, they don't say, where's the party tonight? They say, where's the poetry? They go out, you know, and I was sponsored there by Kenneth Rexroth, who was a distinguished critic for The Nation and New York Times. I had a public appearance at the Gallery 6 there, a well-known place. Rexroth was attacked for the air, and it seems that there were the poetry center of the university that had a number of poets there. They wouldn't have me, but they did have some of the distinguished poets Including those from the University of Minnesota. But they wouldn't have loan funds. So we took to the air and he said, if it comes to choosing between the stars and bars and the hammer and sickle, I will stand up for Lowell Brothers poetry. And you know, the stars and bars means the Confederacy. You see, he was appointed to the Southern School of Poets who still have all the stars and bars, of which you have some examples right here in imports. Not native, well, in Paris. We used to make limericks up together, and he and Carolyn and I were part of the group that would meet every Saturday night at Fort Madox Court. I was very surprised when I returned to this country and invited him to join the League of American Writers. He met me at the Hotel Bevoort. He and Carolyn, and I told him I'd like to join the League of American Writers. And he said, well, what's the program? I said, well, they're against war and fascism. He said, well, what makes you think I'm against war and fascism? So that was the last time I saw Alan. Suddenly realized I hadn't known the man at all. All we'd done was make up limericks in Paris. Well,
that's my riff, and I certainly agree with him that it's a very important weapon. And something that needs much more examination and use.
And extract the poetry from the farmers. Yeah. They're full of poetry.
That's,
I wish that
true. That's true.
You could go out in the countryside here sometime. You have to come back.
To folk song over the past years. I have a long discussion on tape with Pete Siegel on this whole matter. 1937, when we began to use a combination of folk song and such as you heard before, Get Behind Me Satan, there was a very small audience among the people for it. We had a building audience, but now there's an audience of millions. And Tennessee William, the 16 ton, is only one of them. There are many others that are being sung, maybe not as widely as that. But there's a tremendous amount. A million guitars were sold last year. I think it's part of the general upsurge of interest in folk singing, folk songs. And my book, we were at the right spot. Let me just make sure before I... This book that I'm working on, and it's in conjunction with a hymn. In the book, it occurs with a hymn. Now, we're producing, we just improvised the production there. So what you're going to hear is my appearance in there reciting a poem, a sonnet, accompanied by a hymn. It's a very famous Quaker hymn. You won't hear the words of the hymn because we didn't have any mics, so I will tell you what the words are as you hear the hymn.
Fusion to redeem our age. How shall we keep on loving with no fear of unborn children tattooed with its rage? I thought I saw the children of the sun, or was it dreaming, lifting up their hands in rows of unborn from the earth? I thought I saw them marked with strontium. I thought I saw them, children of all lands, pleading with us, the lovers, for their birth.
My life flows on and ends. No matter where he is, transport, not persuasion. For the poet's craft is not a branch of authorship, it's the stuff of which our lives are made. To the wolf, we are all Siberians, all small life. In a poem, we are each unique, opening each morning the shutters of our sleep on new native faces. A poem measures the specific gravity of human beings against the pressures of their time. Weighs how each gets on and off the universal scale as it moves from fossil footprints to tomorrow's rockets. It is sometimes thought that the age of prophecy is done. I think we are in the infancy of vision. The real problem lies ahead, not to have vision, but to live this visionary reality. The goal of life isn't socialism. The goal of socialism is to live. Some of us see this as a tragic age, with the individual denied. I think that defines the limits wherein their sense of history as a living human process is confined. I'm in love with this goddess of history, even as she drives her triumphant car over heaps of us. In her flashing eye is the secret of the way the ball rolls. She whispers to every heart that can hear an old story never fully told. The slightest sibilance of her breath makes the Tinsel Mountains crumple as we move on. Behind lies everything inert, vanquished, out of which human beings of tomorrow arise. The song that counts is the one that hears even in the beginning, the end. The only tragedy is not living the fulfillment of one's own age. The value of human life becomes revealed on a grand scale as men and women rid themselves of ancient fears, age-old burdens, the load of stone they have carried on their shoulders since the Stone Age. How can we have fear? How can we ever be alone? We are the age the ancient prophets foretold, the triumph of history, the victory of science, of humanity, of love over all inhuman things. Thank you very much.
And then they tore up the bookshelves and the books and made as much of debris around there as possible. And then there was some evangelist, this Father Weber.
Oh, yes, Father Weber.
Who was a radio minister who was helping to whip up the general atmosphere.
He had a temple.
Yeah.
Baptist.
Like, what's his name?
An evangelist of some kind.
Father, who was it?
Coughlin at that time?
Father Coughlin. He was on the same track as Father Coughlin.
And after some of these things had taken place, which had served the purpose of whipping up a August 17th of 1940, these arrests took place.
Simultaneously.
They took place simultaneously in
liquor warrants.
Yeah, the question of the liquor warrants played a big part later in the trials because...
Liquor warrants?
Oklahoma's a dry state.
Oh.
And they didn't come with warrants relating to the particular prosecution that later developed.
They couldn't get them? Was that the reason?
The Constitution has to be specific.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't get anybody to make out warrants of
well,
the criminal syndicate.
Either that or they had been in a...
They just made them out in a big hurry.
Their authority under the warrants was to search for intoxicating liquors. And not for books, pamphlets, reading material. Perhaps it was because at that time... before the prosecutions themselves, judges before whom they would go for the warrants would be somewhat surprised to find that they were being asked for warrants, to grant warrants, to search for books, because books as yet...
You think it showed a weakness that they couldn't get the warrants for?
It just showed that they didn't give a dang. They thought that they were...
Well, it might have shown that they feared the Democratic judges, too, couldn't it?
No.
You don't think so? Oh, then why didn't they just get them under that?
But to them, they'd never... This was new for them, too, remember?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't used to this. So they swore off their hands.
Anyway, with the use of these liquor warrants, they searched in homes for books, the bookstore, in order later in the trials to substantiate the fact that they really had been looking for liquor when the question of the validity of the warrants came up. This was a source of some... amusement.
I suppose it threw some onus upon
the validity of the raids and the type of warrants. But they did, from a few of the assorted homes that they had raided, brought in a few bottles of wine.
They did not. They took a half a gallon of wine from your apartment. And that was it. I remember
well,
that.
No, there may have been some... others, but at one stage in one of the trials, why they brought this wine in and had it on the table, just to show, you know, that they really had been there to search for
liquor.
They had the wine there as evidence to show that they really had been there to search for liquor. They had just run into the other things by accident. Then there was a recess in court that day, and the judge and the attorneys for the prosecution and the defense went into the judge's chamber to discuss different legal and extra legal questions, and when they came back from the recess, the bottle was gone and empty. They had drunk up the evidence.
Well, that's how important it was.
But
so what did they seize all the books?
They raided the bookstore.
Yes,
they seized all of the books. There was a special sale in the county jail for books.
Look.
There was a special sale
for these books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They also stayed around the bookstore after they took possession of it and arrested all of the people who came up to the bookstore that day. People who came in to buy books, they arrested.
And furthermore, they had old Dan, what's his name? That detective who disguised himself as a working man in dirty, greasy clothes and a beard. You know, not a real, you know, a 5 o'clock shadow. And he went up and he bought State and Revolution, Communist Manifesto, Price, Value, and Profit. Those three pamphlets, you know, on a predetermined move from Bob, wasn't it?
Yeah.
As evidence. And it was so funny on the stand.
And
when they did it.
Then later in each of the trials were held individually. In each of the trials, this particular detective would testify how he had gone up there and they had sold him these books. And that was the essence of the crime.
I mean, each one of you had an individual trial?
We had separate trials.
Bob was first.
Well, we'll go into that later because it relates to something else. Well, these raids took place, and all of the people arrested were thrown into jail. Now, this includes some of the people who were the... open officials of the Communist Party, the people who were running the bookstore. It also included people who just happened to come up to the bookstore that day.
What were they charged with?
Same thing. They were not later formally charged, but they were held. Of the 40 people who were arrested, there were 12 who were formally charged. But it also included people like my brother-in-law, who had been out there on a visit. My sister, her husband, and little baby girl had just come out.
They had just come
to Oklahoma City that day to visit me.
They arrested the baby too?
I hadn't even seen them. And they arrested my brother-in-law when they went to my house.
You charged him with criminal syndicalism?
And he was charged with criminal syndicalism. He was there on a visit. He was held for several weeks. He was beaten up in jail. My sister and the baby had to get on the train and go back to New York.
Well, the only reason Joyce wasn't arrested, they were going to take her and the baby, is because she raised so much hell about Ella, about the baby.
They let her go back.
Just let her go. No, then she came over to our house, my house, and stayed for a few days, and then we really didn't know where the guys were, and they were under $100,000 bail.
You didn't know they were arrested?
We knew they were arrested.
You didn't know how
But we didn't know where they were, because we called, and there was no information. So finally, after a few days, she went back with the baby, just with clothes on their back, practically. They left all their clothes. I remember that. And she went back in tennis shoes and a red rayon sort of sport dress.
Without knowing what her husband was charged with or where he was.
That's right. He was charged with criminal syndicalism, we found out.
So he was there visiting his brother-in-law, me.
we
hadn't even seen each other, and he found himself in jail.
Alan and I had been secretly married. I was working as a social work in Ardmore, and I was driving back to meet Alan and Joyce and Max, and we were going to go to the falls. What was the name of the falls?
Turner Falls,
a few miles from Oklahoma City, for a weekend that I had never met them. And they came, and they were there one night, maybe, I don't remember, a few hours, and finds her husband in jail, charged with a crime that was worth 20 years and $10,000.
Did he have any basis for understanding any of this?
Oh, sure.
Oh, that's good. I thought maybe he was just a businessman from New York or something.
No, he was arrested. He was taken to jail. He was beaten up. Quite a few of those who were arrested were beaten up. What had happened was that the sheriffs had given some of... We were each put in different tanks, different groups of prisoners. And the sheriffs had spoken to some of the other prisoners beforehand and had given them whiskey.
Drink, I think.
And egged them on to beat up some of these Reds who were being brought up into the different cells and tanks. And in quite a few cases, they were beaten up and some, roughed up pretty much. The tank that I was put into, very soon after I got there, the fellows asked me to sit down and play poker with them. And I did. In some of the other tanks, fellows had asked these people who were arrested to sit down and play poker with them. They had said no, and this had been the immediate provocation for beating them up. It just happened that I lost in this first poker game.
Oh, that's a thousand bags of Bull Durham.
That was good for you too, wasn't it?
It wasn't on purpose, but it turned out that it was good. We played for what was known as commissary. Of course, none of the prisoners had any money.
Carl Winter said one of the terrible problems they had in prison was that the criminals, most of them are murderers, and that they really tried to identify themselves with them as being against the government.
Yeah.
I mean, they were against the government, so.
Well, after a period of time, this is to run.
Weren't you allowed to call out or get a lawyer
No
one knew they were.
Quite a period of time went by before we were allowed to see any attorneys or get in touch with them.
Well, of course. Who got in touch with Moman? Moman Pruitt. And that's a story in itself.
I don't know who.
Was he an attorney?
He was an old man, an attorney.
He was an old
one of the biggest criminal lawyer in Oklahoma.
Like
sort of like, who's the hanging judge? Except I don't think he had as much principle. But a time or two he had seen where the guys had been arrested on little charges, vagrancy or this or that, and he had sort of come to their rescue out of a clear blue sky. I don't remember who made that initial contact with Mormon, unless it was Pat O'Hara.
Could have been.
Someone.
But
young,
he wanted the arrest
guy.
No.
So we got in contact with Mormon Pruitt. And he started his business. I don't know what he did. It was really a mess.
I doubt if he was even a member of the bar, really.
Oh, no. He was a member of the bar.
I mean, what, did he want you to raise money?
Raise money?
First thing he wanted us to do was to bribe the judges.
Oh, I see. One of those.
That's the way he used to get the murderers off.
I mean, he had always had success with this in the past. He didn't understand why it wasn't possible to still go ahead and say more than that. Bribing the judges.
He was an old drunk, filthy old man, what he was.
One of the principals.
Every town has one of those.
One of the much more principled attorneys who later entered the case made a remark that was in a way somewhat similar. This particular attorney, Sam Neuberger, who was from New York, when he had first entered the practice of law, he had somehow or other gotten involved with a bunch of gangsters and criminals as their attorney representing them. And after we got to the third or fourth conviction on these criminal syndicalism cases, one day he just scratched his head and he said, I just don't understand it. When I first started practicing law, everyone I represented was guilty, and I got an acquittal every time. He says, now I come out here, and everyone I represent is innocent, and all we get is convictions. So Mormon thought that the regular methods of being able to deal with justice, of buying off the judges, he just went on the principle.
Probably. That he had his old axe to grind. He must have.
Well, he went on the principle that each of these judges was the best judge money could buy, and he tried to buy them.
He was very realistic, as a matter of fact.
So we had a mess with him for a while.
Well, we were getting a subsidy of $15 a week from New York money order, and somehow or other he managed to get that post office box open, and he confiscated those checks.
He took them.
Yes, he did. And I was so dumb I didn't know what it was all about anyway. So.
How'd you get rid of him?
Oh, we finally gave him a fee and paid him off and hired some attorneys. Finally, we ended up with two attorneys from Oklahoma, George Kroon from Tulsa, Stanley Melvin from Cushing, two very fine attorneys who had help and assistance from co-attorneys from Chicago and from New York. Well, the first period of time, we were all in jail. As Nina Beth mentioned, the bail was set at $100,000 for each of us.
Each one?
For each of us. And the first period of time was one, as is usual in these cases, of trying to get the bail reduced to some reasonable figure. Many hearings were held on this, and finally the bail was reduced to sums figuring from...
$20,000 for Elizabeth, whose parents put up the bail.
Ranging down to about 2,500 for some of the people.
5,000, I think.
Clarence...
How long did this take? You were in jail all this time, right?
Well, they...
Bob came out
I was in jail for about 5 months, but the bail was not at $100,000 for all of the 5 months. It was finally reduced to $7,500, and it was a question of raising it.
Were you able to form a committee or anything during this time?
No, in this very first period, there was no committee formed.
there was more or less a general feeling of shock at what had happened.
Didn't we form the committee while you were still in jail?
Yeah, but it was not at the very first period. There were some interesting things as we talk about and think of. Of course, this we didn't see until sometime later, those of us who were in jail. But after the day of the arrest, there were newspaper articles saying that they had doubled the watch on the county jail.
Yeah.
And so forth, as though they expected the jail to be stormed and these raids freed or something like that.
Was there much sentiment aroused for you in the community or amongst the liberals? Or?
Not at first, Meridale, I don't think.
No, at first there was very little. There was a general feeling of fear that existed. And it was reflected in the reluctance of people to speak out and say anything. Although later on...
Well, I think the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is the one who turned the tide.
Mm-hmm.
Because they did a beautiful full page, well, half page, I guess it was, editorial.
No, it was a full page.
Do you have that here anywhere? You don't have
no,
it?
I had it once, but
I've got a grudge on that one. What's his name from, who was the cartoon?
Oh, Fitzpatrick did it.
Fitzpatrick,
I remember that's when
picture of the Statue of Liberty.
I think I first heard of it now.
And they gave a...
None of these relate to the
big column.
I see these about Milwaukee. Now.
Editorial, feature stories and so forth that really broke the ice in these cases. But up at that time, at one point, I think you were still in jail when we formed the Oklahoma Committee to Defend Political Prisoners.
Yeah. Of course.
And we rented an office and set up a typewriter.
Who's we? You and the...
Well,
who's left
whoever
outside.
Was around, yeah. I had my name on the stationery because, you know, no one else wanted to, actually, is what it amounted to. And we had a typewriter desk, names, and we started, finally, editing with Elizabeth was really the one that set that up. Editing a little monthly mimeograph bulletin of news on the trial and so forth, asking for funds. Well, we did get money, not very much, but at least we did keep people informed of what was going on. It played a small role,
I think. It must have begun the whole thing.
But at a certain point, the resolutions, there was a list of two or three pages of resolutions from trade unions. David Sentner in St. Louis, I think. I've always had a soft spot for him because he was the first union official who came forth with any official announcement from a union on these cases.
Of course,
and
it was very logical there because Bill had a few years before in the Maytag strike in Iowa undergone the same type of prosecution under an Iowa
So then you got out on the bail after, was it 5 or 6 months you were?
About five and a half months that I was in jail.
But in the meantime, after Ellen got out, well, we spent a few days in an old crummy hotel again with Governor Bill Murray.
Next door to Alfalfa Bill Murray, who recently died.
What a crummy joint.
Tobacco juice drooling down his face.
So then we began in the usual tradition of Oklahoma. We went to New York, and meetings were arranged, public and private, and these huge house parties they used to have, and we had, I remember, a dinner with one of the movie stars, a private dinner, you know, and well, things were so different. Public, private house parties and so forth, where the case was spread and money was raised. And,
this was before the trial.
Well, it was interspersed between trials and after the trial. Meanwhile, more and more people began to speak out.
There
was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch thing.
Well, when did you bury the books?
When was that?
Before.
That must have been before. Or was it after Alan?
No, that was after.
Yeah.
After you got out, you mean?
Yeah. Then Mr. Roosevelt... spoke out.
Was
that
the guy
that
came
effect.
From Kansas City or Chicago, the young youth leader?
Bob Wirtz, I think.
No. Well, whatever his name. Anyway, I had written to Mrs. Roosevelt asking for a contribution and a statement. So she wrote back and sent $25, but she said, I can't make a statement because I don't know enough about the case and so forth and so on. That came in the early fall, and then the pressure was put on and put on and put on, but she asked that this be confidential, and I think this was a real crime. Anyway, this guy came down and said, oh, Mrs. Roosevelt, she knows, she expects this anyway, you know, make it public. And I thought it was unethical. You must have been still in jail.
Yeah, you were.
And I said, all right, but let's at least wait until after November election. Roosevelt was running again. So after the elections, I went down, and this was stupid. I had a photostat made of the check and the letter. And then we called the reporters and released it, and they printed a picture of the photostat and the copy. And I think to this day, in editorials occasionally, they refer to the fact in the Daily Oklahoman that Mrs. Roosevelt had given us $25. That was really terrible.
Did she protest it or do anything?
Oh, after I saw it, I became panic-stricken. I sent her a great big long telegram.
Well, no, she her statement, as I remember, was more positive than that.
Well, she made a statement on it, too. But anyway.
She never protested or made anything of it.
No.
There was interviews, yes, there were interviews. I remember some of the interviews. I think she said it was a case of civil liberties and she was interested, and that was all. And I sent her a wire of apology, and that was it. That was terrible.
Or
was it she asked you to dinner at the White House
at
2 or whatever it was? Oh, that was earlier.
That was before that.
Before you got out? You mean
whether? No, that was when I was still in
school. Leonbeth had written to Mrs. Roosevelt on the basis of having met her before.
But anyway, that happened.
Well, as the trials took place and as the meaning of the trials became clearer, more and more people throughout the country and in Oklahoma began to speak out and say something. The trials took place in this form. The first three people tried were Bob Wood and Ida Wood and Eli Jaffe. They were tried on the book charge, and each of them separately convicted, sentenced to 10 years in prison and a fine of $5,000.
That was on selling
books. And I was tried on the charge of membership and also convicted in the same sentence, 10 years and $5,000. These were the only four of us who were tried. Each of the cases was appealed, and there was a sort of unwritten agreement that there would not be any further trials until the outcome of the appeals on these, which covered both charges, the selling books and membership. At a period then of 3 years went by before there was any decision on the cases. And during these 3 years, there were a considerable number of people who began to speak out. On the basis of the people who spoke out, more and more material was able to be gotten out, more and more people were reached on the issues that were involved in these cases. And as Lita Beth mentions, before too long had gone by, there was quite an accumulation of individuals and organizations throughout the country who had spoken up. Well, the outcome of it was that in about 3 years after the original arrests, the Supreme Court reversed the convictions.
The Circuit Court of Appeal in Oklahoma?
No.
Oh!
Supreme Court.
On Schneiderman.
The state Supreme Court, the Oklahoma Supreme Court. Dick Jones, and Barefoot, and whoever the third.
Okay.
Judge. Sure. It wasn't the federal case.
Oh, yes.
When did this take place in Norman? The Fiery Cross.
Oh, that was some years later. That was 1950.
Oh, you were the chairman of the party there? Yeah. I didn't know that. As late as that.
I was speaking at a meeting at the university. It was during the early period of the Korean War, and they burnt this cross outside of the...
Yeah, it was Hillel.
Yeah, I see it. How about you reading this one and put it on the tape? Just like it's told, it's so like dramatic. On? Yeah.
OU Fiery Cross meets Connie. Threats are hurled at party chairman. Norman, Oklahoma, January 10th, 1950. A group of University of Oklahoma students Tuesday night attempted to break up a meeting of the Campus Civil Rights Committee, which was being addressed by Alan Shaw, chairman of the Oklahoma Communist Party. The first outbreak came when a cross was set afire in the front yard of the Hillel House, where the meetings were being held. Alan Shaw had just finished his speech to an audience of about 40 persons. Glenn Wilson, a Daily Oklahoman campus reporter, was jumped by three students as he left the house. He had been reporting the meeting and left to send an account of the cross burning. As he approached a dark corner near Hamburg Hall, three men grabbed him and called him a dirty communist, also shouting profanity. After a short scuffle, Wilson broke loose and escaped in the darkness. As Shaw finished his speech and began a question period, shouts of, "Come out before we burn the house," interrupted him. While the cross burned, students drove by in cars. Others stood across the street yelling at those inside the building. The group that burned the cross apparently was not large, although no witnesses could say just how many were involved. "See, this is what I mean about losing your freedom," Shaw declared calmly, as about 40 people in the Hillel House stood at windows and doors watching the cross burn. "This is a symbol of the very thing I've been talking about," he added. "Mass hysteria and closed minds are spreading in the country. That symbol that the Ku Klux Klan should appear on a college campus is especially alarming." Even before the blaze was burned out, the meeting continued. The Norman Fire Department was called, but the fire was dying down by the time it arrived. Norman police also quickly reached the scene, sending the men in cars and on the sidewalk hurrying away. When the meeting broke up later, members of the Civil Rights Committee circulated a petition denouncing the conviction of 11 communist leaders in the recent New York trial. After the meeting, an OU official pointed out that the university does not officially recognize the committee. The cross, approximately 15 by 5 feet, was made of 2x2 wood and apparently was doused in gasoline before it was set off. The Civil Rights Committee, a liberal campus organization founded only a few weeks ago, held a meeting in the campus home of the Hillel Foundation, although the foundation has no connection with the group. The Interreligious Council was also meeting in another part of the house when the cross was set fire.
What was the name of the street? The one that led to Packingtown? 23rd Street. To Temple? What is it called?
But he must have been a Baptist.
He was a fundamentalist.
He wasn't a Catholic.
Whatever he was. No, he was a Baptist or fundamentalist of some sort.
Or
and he, one of these guys who increased his congregation considerably, and he had an open-air arena, sort of, for summer meetings, and it was during the trials, remember, that he somehow or other got some of the books that were taken when you were arrested, and they put them in the middle of the arena and burned them.
I'm not sure about what, these were books that were taken in one of the raids that had been made on the
Well, that might have been
before
it.
The
that might have been.